Hello, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
And Vince, you're already dreaming of September, I see, wearing your TIFF shirt.
Yeah, you're not going to kill this dream, my friend. Skipped out this year, so I have to, you know, have the relic from the past.
A dream of fall.
I remember, actually, I think you called me TIFF boy around that time, 2016, when I was like a guest at TIFF, and then I came back, and I would not stop talking about TIFF, and I absolutely deserve that TIFF boy moniker.
Well, we'll see if it makes a comeback.
Yes, yeah.
End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the bizarrely unsettling horror drama Midsommar. Midsommar, with an A.
I like that. I like that emphasis.
Good.
Midsommar sounds too much like a, I don't know, like a cable sitcom or something.
Yes. Like that season of Saved by the Bell where they worked at the beach.
Right. Yeah. I like the Swedish emphasis on that. Distinguish that.
Anyway, that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including retirement. While Quentin Tarantino is talking about retiring, Woody Allen is talking about dying on set. But seriously, why can't he just die? And then Momo the movie, the internet meme slash hoax has been optioned for a movie, but can you really turn a meme into something resembling a movie? And then finally, it's been 20 years since the Blair Witch Project, and we'll talk about why the police and the authorities still haven't found those three kids. They're still missing. Anyway.
Did Twitter not figure that out? I thought they were very good at solving these mysteries.
No.
Okay.
No, they're still missing.
Interesting.
But first... Dwayne The Rock Johnson, he is one of the biggest movie stars in the world, but why does he seem to have such terrible taste in projects? And this is in reference to an article on the AV Club, which I thought was had some interesting points, which is that Dwayne The Rock Johnson, one of the biggest movie stars in the world, but seems to habitually work with some of, like, two primary directors. One is Ross and Marshall Thurman, who made Skyscraper and Central Intelligence and the upcoming Red Notice that starred Johnson. And the other is Brad Peyton, who made Rampage, San Andreas, and Journey 2.
Who's actually a friend of my professor in film school, actually.
Well, Brad Peyton is Canadian.
Yes,
I believe he's from Atlantic Canada.
Yeah.
But in between, you know, he does the Fast and the Furious movies, which, you know, does really the only opportunity for him to work with, you know, talented, accomplished filmmakers like James Wan or F. Gary Gray or Justin Lin.
Right.
And the question is, you know, does Johnson choose loyalty over being challenged? Like, does he choose, like, just perpetuating the Rock brand as opposed to, you know, actually challenging himself as an artist? And should he?
Yeah. I don't even know where to begin with this. It's like... First of all, you would have to know, in order for you to, like, want to work with good directors, you would have to know what a good director is. I'm absolutely certain that Dwayne The Rock Johnson does not know a good director from a bad director, right? Probably does not know what a good director does. And you see people like Jonah Hill, right, who are, like, taking huge pay cuts, taking only $60,000 to work with their idol, Martin Scorsese, right? That's
right.
A guy who had a passion for cinema and then had an opportunity to kind of live out those dreams, right? And you take a risk. You take a risk when you're working with these people and you're making material like that. And obviously, Jonah Hill recognized that, right? But I doubt Dwayne Johnson has any of those people that he's like, oh, I just want to work with him or I want to work with her or whatever. And even if he did, I doubt he would take a pay cut to do that. Look at the way this guy talks about movies. It's like his PR person, like, just fed him what to say, right? Like, after, I forget what movie of his bombed. It was, like, Skyscraper or something. Mm. He was like, well, this is, like, a global economy, man. We're going to, like, make a profit. And it's like, dude, nobody's talking about the profit.
Mm-hmm.
You made a bad movie. That's what we're talking about.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what really matters to you. Like, does making art matter? Does making money matter? And I mean, the two things don't need to be mutually exclusive, you know, because I think the Fast and the Furious movies, especially the latter ones, maybe we'll give a mulligan to Fate of the Furious. But you know, 5, 6, 7, those are like solid action movies.
Yes.
And, you know, it just seems like you can combine art. There is an art to making a really good action movie. And he's working with David Leitch on the spinoff Hobbs and Shaw. David Leitch, of course, made John Wick, Atomic Blonde, Deadpool 2. So obviously talented. He's a former stuntman, so he knows action. And it just seems like on those films, he really should know that, like, when you work on those films, which are made by unquestionable craftsmen, and then you get to the set of Skyscraper, you know, it goes to your point. Maybe he should know the difference between good directing and bad directing, but I think it is a matter of him not caring. And I think maybe there's a question of, like, maybe should he care? Because, you know, these things ebb and wane, right? You know, he is a movie star. He's always going to have bombs. He's always going to have hits. But when he's looking back at the end of the day, you know, is he going to, you know, when he's 75 and, you know, he can't lift weights anymore and he's just like on the porch of the old folks home or whatever, he's going to be looking back and like going, yeah, but Skyscraper made money in China.
Yeah, no. No, the answer is that he doesn't care. He does not care about the artistic integrity of movies. And that's okay, right? Like, he occupies a very classic niche in cinema, right? That has been occupied by many other action stars before, right? And it's like, why do you need to now branch out and win a Golden Globe? You know what I mean? It's like when Jim Carrey was like, well, it's kind of disappointing that the Oscars don't have a comedy section. And it's like, why? Why can't you just be happy occupying your little section of cinema? Why do you have to do the big drama stuff? It's like, people are obviously appreciating what you're doing. And I would argue that Dwayne Johnson did try to, like, do something different with that movie Snitch he did a long time ago.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I mean, he has nobody cared and it didn't make money, so he, like, probably just didn't want to do it again. But, like, I think, okay, a man coming from the WWF, where it's all spectacle, it's all exaggeration, it's all, you know, this kind of larger-than-life thing. Can he really be expected to know what quality cinema is? Or I think that's just the logical progression of his career. You know what I mean? WWF to bigger Hollywood stuff. And it's like, well, he's not Edward Norton, like, struggling, getting rejected, you know, taking heed of where, you know, my strengths and talents lie. It's not about that. It's ridiculous. And also, you're assuming that these directors just need an opportunity to work with them. It's like, how do you know these directors want to work with Dwayne Johnson? They don't. Maybe. They might not be.
But, I mean, I was laughing because I was imagining Dwayne Johnson in American History X.
But I didn't mean to instill that image in your head.
Sorry. No, but, I mean, at the same time, he has an incredible work ethic. And, I mean, and that very much comes from the world of wrestling. Like, wrestling is a tough gig. You know, it's not just like the WrestleMania and the glitz and the glamour and the spectacle. I mean, there's like hours of training. There's, you know, rehearsal because it's fake. There's all the touring that has to be done, all the personal appearances. It's a grind.
But all of that work is not resulting in good art, is what I'm saying,
well,
right?
Depends.
It's like yes, absolutely. That's my opinion. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, but I also don't think like,
but I think what the EV Club article was getting at, like, it's not unusual for people in Johnson's position to, like, want to stretch. If you look at somebody like Schwarzenegger, you could in like 85, you could go back and say, well, he's just like a bodybuilder. But no, he leveraged his success and his talent, so he ends up working with people like James Cameron, Ivan Reitman on like,
I
Twins
thought
and
about
Kindergarten
this.
Cop.
I'm sorry, I thought okay. about this, man. Like, Schwarzenegger was not picked by James Cameron for his extraordinary acting abilities. As
no.
a matter of fact, it was the opposite,
right.
Because all he's doing is acting like a robot who doesn't act. So it's like, yeah, the real success of all of those movies was James Cameron and not Schwarzenegger, and then you spent the rest of your career doing the same thing, right? Like being the kind of mindless action hero. So I don't think Schwarzenegger should be seen as a bastion of success. It's like, yes, you were incredibly successful in that business, but that's not the definition of success, success that I have, right? Because your movies were not very good.
Well, the other example I'm thinking of is like Tom Cruise, too. Like Tom Cruise, you know, challenged, has actually continued to challenge himself. And I mean, it's more of like the physical way. With some of the Mission Impossible stunts now, but you know, you think about some of the people he's worked with, like Scorsese. He's worked with PTA.
Yeah, Oliver Stone or whatever. But
like, he picked Brian De Palma to direct the first Mission Impossible, and like,
I think he has a physicality that can like adhere or is good for both of those kind of things. Dwayne Johnson, you take one look at him, and you're like, okay, there's really only a narrow market that you fit into, bro. And sometimes like, you know, who's that guy from Guardians of the Galaxy?
Dave Bautista.
Dave Bautista can like is now sometimes kind of doing both, right? With he had a little bit of a change with Blade Runner 2049, but it was like,
and he's in Dune too. He's in Film Institute.
Right. So so maybe there is something to be said for you know, and having those big kind of action heroes in things with integrity.
And John Cena, like, he tried to follow The Rock or Dwayne Johnson. Like, he did, what was that movie he did? The Countdown or The Marine. He did some, like, stupid action movie where he's trying to save his wife from, like, a weirdo terrorist.
Yeah, I think it was The Marine.
Yeah, but along comes Trainwreck. He does a 180-degree turn. He's playing the comic relief. And he, you know, he goes from there and he goes to Blockers. And I mean, he took a lot, you know, went back to sort of action-y stuff in the Transformers spinoff, Bumblebee. But he was actually pretty good in that, too. And he was arguably better than any of the other sort of military characters who have ever been in any of those movies. And that might have just been the fact that it was Travis Knight directing as opposed to Michael Bay. He's like,
yeah.
But, I mean, it's not impossible for people who come from a wrestling background to shirk expectations, to change things up.
Yeah. And you know, Channing Tatum kind of did the same thing as well. He
absolutely
had his part in Foxcatcher. Yeah, all right. Maybe it does take a director with an open mind to kind of see where these people fit in.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Speaking of will, Woody Allen says he has no plans of retiring. In fact, if I do die, he said at a press conference, it would probably be on a film set.
Mm-hmm.
This is coming in the face of the release of his latest movie, A Rainy Day in New York, which he is self-releasing because Amazon put the kibosh on his four-picture deal.
Why is that? Because of the poor reception of his TV series? Or because of his reputation as a filmmaker?
I think they did it after Dylan Farrow wrote an op-ed saying that he molested her as a child.
Okay, fair enough, yeah.
Not that that's funny, but it's, you know, this has sort of been something that's been coming for Woody Allen for a long time. You know, going back to when he left his partner, Mia Farrow, for her adopted daughter, who was several decades his junior.
Well, that's the thing. It's not like there are allegations against him or just allegations. It's like there's actually like a creepy kind of open reality to this.
Yeah.
But Woody Allen strikes me as that kind of guy who just
a creep
eschews that as well, but eschews the kind of I don't know, the news or the popular opinions about him, and just kind of has done his own thing. I mean, he's pumped out like one movie a year since like the early 70s.
He's undoubtedly prolific.
Yes. So if it's like, if he was going to, I don't know. But then you also have to look at what those films are, right? I think he's repeated himself, regurgitated the same storyline.
Yes.
Many, many times, right?
Well, I would point out that A Rainy Day in New York is about a photographer played by Jude Law, who is in his 40s, who starts to covet a 15-year-old girl played by Elle Fanning.
Right.
So a little on brand.
Yes. There is a novel Woody Allen premise. But isn't it funny also how you can kind of get flack just for working with them now too?
Yeah.
It's almost like a risk just to work with them because you know you're going to be kind of sneered at a bit.
Well, it's not even just that. It's like there are people who are involved in this movie, like Rebecca Hall and Timothée Chalamet, who donated their salaries to charity and apologized for, you know, working with Woody Allen. On the other hand, he's casting his next thing, and he's got Christoph Waltz and Gina Gershon and Elena Anaya in it. And it's just like he still has no trouble attracting talent, because like there have been a few people, like also Ellen Page, who have said that, you know, they can't work with him again and regret maybe working with him in the past, because I mean the allegations have been there this whole time, and what sort of made it an imperative now is sort of the wrecking ball of Me Too. It's just been this snowball effect, this avalanche, where even, you know, the whiff of allegations, not even just, you know, the what's been said about Woody Allen, but, you know, people like George Takei, who, like, one person comes out and makes an allegation, and, you know, he gets sucked up into it, and Aziz Ansari, the list goes on and on. But Woody Allen seems to not be entirely sucked up into that gravitational field. He's able to escape somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is, and there, I mean, it's also the Michael Jackson thing all over again, because, you know, how do you divorce Michael Jackson from music history?
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's a bit different in Michael Jackson's case, because Michael Jackson's been dead for 10 years. So it's very much in the historical. He's not producing albums anymore. But it's which makes the Woody Allen case interesting. Woody Allen's still making films, mm-hmm. but you can't, I don't think, amputate Woody Allen's filmography from film history, because it's had such an effect on the way, you know, romantic comedies and comedies have been made in the last 40 years.
For sure. The same way that Birth of a Nation is an incredibly, like, significant movie in film history, but also happens to be very racist by that standard, but certainly by contemporary standards.
Right.
Unbelievably racist. So,
yeah.
But then it's like, you know, Roman Polanski seems to be getting in more trouble than Woody Allen, even though it could be argued that they're both kind of sketchy individuals. It's like, where do you draw the line, right? Like, where do you draw the line and say, no, we're revoking your membership from the Academy, but not yours, even though we've kind of, they've both been in hot water. It's like, how do you...
I guess, I mean, they've cut the cheese really thin, because you could say Roman Polanski's been convicted.
That's fair, yeah.
But, I mean, there's only the one victim in that case, one known victim, admittedly, but that victim has gone on the record to say she has forgiven Polanski.
Mm-hmm.
And shouldn't she be the one to sort of dictate terms? But I mean, I find it troubling that he seems to not be troubled. I mean, I find it troubling that, you know, people like Louis C.K. is constantly sort of plotting his comeback, and people like Matt Lauer are kind of like, they're kind of walking around the house trying to find a way to get back in, maybe without anyone noticing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if there was some sort of acknowledgement that there's some stuff, he doesn't have to do a confessional, but I think people just want an acknowledgement,
mm-hmm.
and for him to like sort of keep going on like nothing has happened is what really gets people. And when he comes out and says like, no, I'm going to keep going forever, I will die on a movie set, it reinforces to a lot of people who feel very very particular about this that, you know, he doesn't care, he doesn't get it.
Yeah.
And I think that stings more than the actual allegations.
Yeah, well said.
Well, since if that was well said enough, let's take a quick break and come back with some more horrors from the internet. Anyway, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. And The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore. That's a classic by the Walker Brothers, and it has a connection to our film of the week, which we'll get into shortly. But Midsommar is kind of traumatic, in much the same way that Momo was traumatic.
Which I don't recall.
You don't recall really. Momo?
I remember the like trend of like these kind of sinister online things, but I don't remember this one. I remember the image of like a lady, like bird kind of hybrid, but I don't remember the folklore or whatever around it.
Well, it was a hoax.
Yeah.
It was this idea that people were inserting this image of Momo into viral videos, mostly aimed at children, and that Momo would be giving the kids a series of challenges leading up to a dare to basically commit suicide.
Right, or harm somebody else or something.
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Well, that was like the challenges leading up to it, and then the final challenge is kill yourself.
Except there was no evidence that this was actually taking place.
There was exactly zero evidence.
Right.
And the Momo itself started out as a sculpture called Mother Bird, which was exhibited at the Vanilla Gallery in Tokyo in 2016. And the artist is a Japanese artist, and her name is Kisu Aso.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, like, people would go to the Vanilla Gallery and take pictures of this bizarre-looking thing called Mother Bird. And eventually becomes this meme. But don't worry, Orion Pictures and Vertigo Entertainment have bought the rights to make Momo the movie.
Right. Digging through the archives of useless things they can make a movie about, they have stumbled upon Momo, and now we are graced with a movie.
Well, maybe.
Maybe. Producers of The Ring and
The Grudge.
The Grudge. So we obviously know what that's going to be. Like, it's going to be a pop-out scare with a very weak plot. That's going to be all about the jumps. So go ahead and do your Momo,
you know,
movie, Orion.
That's what makes it interesting, because the sculpture is kind of like a reference to a Japanese myth about a woman who dies in childbirth.
It's honestly such a terrifying sculpture. Like, makes me unsettled just to look at it. Like, I don't, regardless of the hoax, it's like, even as a work of art, it's like, this is weird and creepy, and I don't want to look at this.
Yeah, but, you know, there's kind of a mythology to it. And if they wanted to dig into that a bit more, I mean, these are people who successfully adapted very Japanese movies for an American audience. So would they be able to, you know, maybe take all these elements of Momo, the meaning of the sculpture, the internet ephemera angle, and like combine it into something that's compelling? On the other hand, I'm thinking about other movies that have been made out of internet memes, like Slender Man.
Yes.
Which was terrible.
Yeah.
The Bye Bye Man, which was terrible. I saw them both, so I can say on authority they're terrible.
So you can spare me from having to watch.
Yes, you're fine without having to watch them.
Right.
You're not missing, like, I think the Beware the Slender Man documentary on HBO was scarier than the Slender Man movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the Slender Man movie, one of the things that galls you is that you have this character, the Slender Man, which I think he has a very iconic look. You could have really turned him into a terrifying movie character. I don't remember a single scene in Slender Man with the actual Slender Man character.
Right, because these people aren't wanting to do justice to the material. They just, like, it's popular, so we're going to take advantage of the fact that it's popular and try and make a buck off of it, right?
Yeah.
They can't even properly adapt, like, video games that have been out for 20 years.
I was thinking that too, yeah.
Let alone a meme online. It's like, you couldn't even make a good Max Payne movie, let alone like something
Max
that was
Payne.
Kind of a vague internet meme. And these are horror movies too. It's like, it's so easy to just kind of slap a subpar script onto these things and get people to come out for them.
It's true, because like something like the Assassin's Creed movie, the Assassin's Creed games are like very cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have an Assassin's Creed movie. You hire Michael Fassbender, Marion Cotillard. I think Charlotte Rampling is in that too.
And who directed that?
I can't remember his name, but he also did Macbeth, which is why he was so easily able to get Fassbender and Cotillard.
Right.
Jeremy Irons was in it too. But you put together this cast, you have this all, like, incredibly cinematic looking game, and so much of it is spent on like the minutia of like the reincarnation concept and like this modern conspiracy. Like, no, the point of the game is you go to these sort of like settings in medieval and Renaissance Europe, and you have this character who's like leaping around buildings and you know, these awesome fight scenes, and it something happened between we're going to make an Assassin's Creed movie and here's the Assassin's Creed movie, where the things that make the video game great kind of get completely blanched out.
Yeah, I just don't think these people play the game and appreciate what they're about. It's like they just see the opportunity for the material. It's really bizarre because, and I think some of the problem is that they just pick the wrong video games to adapt to. It's like Temple Run, they're now adapting. It's like, okay, well, there are better, more fertile like ideas you could be playing with, but
right, yeah, it's, I mean, I think this is the best video game adaptions. We got into video game adaptions rather than Momo, but the best video game adaptions, I think, are able the ones that are able to like just like capture the simplicity of the concept, like something like the Mortal Kombat movie. Mm-hmm. The minute you try to like complicate things with like alliances and origins, like say the Street Fighter movie, The Legend of
Chun-Li,
thank you. Yeah. With Canadian Kristen Crook as Chun-Li. Look, Kristen Crook's a great actress, but I don't think martial arts is in her skill set. But look,
fair enough.
But I mean, that movie was so full of like alliances and what's Chun-Li's motivation. It's like, no, it's a Street Fighter movie. There's no motivation other than to fight. And that's where Mortal Kombat succeeds. It's like, it's people fighting.
They had like some good kind of motivations, but they just didn't overdo it, right? Like how Johnny Cage is he's being like touted as a fake in Hollywood. Right. He's a fake martial artist, so he's got to prove that he's like a real martial artist. It was like, okay, that's a nice little motivation that I can get behind. You didn't do it too much. I can't imagine, right, with a thin story like a meme or whatever, where there isn't even really a story. There's only kind of the mythology image behind it. Could they really conjure up something effective from scratch?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Speaking of effective mythology, it is the 20th anniversary of the release of The Blair Witch Project, the supposed documentary about three filmmakers who go into the woods in Maryland and never come out, and then their footage is found.
Wasn't 1999 such a great year for movies?
It
I found 1999 such a good year.
Yes. No, it's like kind of like the last year of like sort of like where the year is like truly revolutionary.
Yes, yeah.
For film, and like The Blair Witch is a great example of that. It helps like solidify like it's not the first found footage movie in much the same way that Halloween isn't the first slasher movie, but I mean it helped like
solidify those tropes
the
and
concept.
Those, yes.
Yeah. It was, you know, you had Blair Witch, and then a couple of weeks later you had Sixth Sense, and they helped like reorient horror back to actually being scary.
Yes.
As opposed to being jokey and self-referential.
Well, that's the thing about the Blair Witch Project. They're after this kind of witch, but there isn't a single shot of the witch. It's all kind of this psychological kind of terror of these people navigating through the woods. And it was all, I think it was also the start of these kind of shoestring budget horror films that make extraordinary amounts of money just kind of through word of mouth and a very simplistic concept as well. Mm-hmm. Like Paranormal Activity, obviously, almost 10 years later would do kind of the same thing, right? Like made for even Blair Witch Project, I think, was like made for $60,000 and it's made over $200 million. Like I think it holds a world record. So,
yeah.
But there are all, like, the article that you sent me that we were talking about was suggesting that you could not make the Blair Witch Project anymore, right? It's like,
well, you couldn't make it like the phenomenon.
Yes, because they effectively kind of did this campaign of like, is it real, is it not?
Yeah, they like muddied the waters. They put up like a website. And I think that article that we're both referring to said, like, you know, you could figure out it was fake in like a couple
five
of clips
seconds
of Google.
Twitter would unravel that too now.
Right. And, you know, so it comes out at a time when, like, you can use the internet in a way that we would call viral now. But because the internet is this new thing and people are sort of finding their way about it, you can do something like, these three students are missing, and missing for years, and we found all the documentary footage. And you could, like, legitimately stop and go, like, are they missing? But now, you know, all those three people probably have their own Twitter accounts, and you could find them. And like, oh no, they were at Shake Shack last night or wherever.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I also was surprised to learn that there was never an official trailer for it, which was weird.
Really?
And I heard that, and I was like, that seems like one of those, like, is it Berenstain or Berenstain Bears? Like, because I could have swore I saw a trailer, but it just might have been like TV commercials.
Mm-hmm.
It just might have been like the TV commercials, and then they had the special that the directors produced themselves. That was like the Curse of the Blair Witch, which were like added to this whole idea. Like, is it real or isn't it real? Because like we're doing this documentary about this found footage, and we're talking to locals, and it's, you know, it really muddied the waters about like, is this real? Isn't real?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can't really do that anymore. I mean, the best you can hope for, and I was thinking about this and about like other sort of found footage movie things, is I remember when the Cloverfield trailer came out, and there's no title with the Cloverfield trailer. I think it's just like at the end, it's just like a date and a website, but it opens up and it looks like somebody taking footage at a party, and then it's taken directly from the movie. But then you hear the stomps, and then you hear the screams, and you hear the alarms, and they all go outside. I think the power goes out. They all go outside. And then you see something fly overhead and crash near them, and it's the head of the Statue of Liberty. And that's where the trailer ends.
Right.
And, of course, nobody's, like, thinking that's, like, real because, I mean, we're recording this on Sunday, but, like, just last night there was a power outage in New York, and that was all over CNN and all over the news channel. So if a monster took the head off the Statue of Liberty, we probably would have heard about it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, all you can hope for now with these is the shock value.
Right.
Is the, here's something cool, go check it out. You can't really have, like, the slow build and the anticipation for something like The Blair Witch where you're not 100% sure what it is, if it's real.
And it was also just a good movie, too. Like, I think there were a lot of things.
It holds up.
There were a lot of things working for it, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to something like Snakes on a Plane, where it was this big campaign, this big kind of movement, kind of nice marketing. But then the movie sucked and nobody ended up seeing it. It was like Blair Witch actually had the good marketing and it kind of delivered as a good movie, I would say.
I went to Snakes on a Plane opening night and the theater was full. But I mean, probably everybody who wanted to see Snakes on the Plane was in that theater opening night.
Right, because I went a little later and it was empty.
Yeah.
Theaters. I was like, you know, all you people that were touting how fun this was going to be, where are you?
Yeah, they were there opening night.
Yeah. But you can see what happened with when they tried to remake The Blair Witch. Or not remake it, but they did that
sequel,
right?
Yeah.
And they lost all of the organic kind of stuff that made the first one effective.
Right. And they attempted to, like, do, like, they tried to be sneaky about it because it was Adam Wingard who had done The Guest and a couple other, like, successful small films. And they said, like, now he's doing this movie called The Woods. And then they get to San Diego Comic-Con. And they're like, we're now going to screen The Woods. Actually, it's Blair Witch 3. And and people were like, oh, wow, it's Blair Witch 3. They made a Blair Witch 3. And nobody knew anything. And then when people saw it, it was like, oh, it was okay.
Yeah. But it was like you explained too much, right?
Yeah.
And it's very hard to, like, mm-hmm. when you know that you can never recapture that success,
lightning in a bottle.
All you can ever hope to do is, like, kind of
cash in,
right? So, and not just Blair Witch, but, like, you can see they've done that many times as well.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Paranormal Activity is, like, one of the good examples, actually. Now they've just turned it into a big spectacle, and it's like you've lost sight of what made this
good. The Saw movies as well. Like the right. Saw, like the first Saw was made for like a mil half. And then you, by the time you get to like Saw, like the concluding chapter, the supposed concluding chapter where it was like in 3D.
Yeah.
And it starts with like this elaborate death trap that they filmed in front of Toronto City Hall.
And it's like Jigsaw's been dead for like five movies already. Yeah. And we're just.
But he's still yanking the puppet strings.
Yeah.
Good times. Anyway.
But Blair Witch, what did those directors, they kind of disappeared as well. They were never really able to.
They were never heard from again.
Yes. They also disappeared into the woods, never to be heard of.
I think
screams can be heard in Hollywood.
Might, yeah, they might be okay living off residuals. We'll look into that.
Well, that's, yeah, yeah.
But if you want to keep talking about unsettling things and going into the woods and maybe never coming out, we're going to talk about Midsommar. After this break, you are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Like another world. Amazing. Do people just sleep here?
Yeah, all the younger ones until we turn 36 and then we move to the laborer's house.
Why 36?
Well, we think of life like the seasons. So you're a child until you're 18 and that's spring. And then at some point we all do our pilgrimage, which is between 18 and 36, and that's summer. And then from 36 to 54, we're a working age, which is fall. And then finally, from 54 to 72, you become a mentor.
What happens at 72?
You couldn't hear it, but he did the cut off the neck portion motion with his hand, which we call foreshadowing in the business.
Okay, okay. Let me write that one down.
Yeah, write it down. Right. That was a clip from Midsommar, the new film from Ari Aster, and it stars Florence Pugh, Jack Rayner, William Jackson Harper, Will Poulter, and Wilhelm Blomgren. And it's a trip.
This is a trip. Why can't I stop thinking about this movie?
Oh, I've been thinking about it all week.
Yeah. This is such a bizarre, beautiful, dark, disturbing, weird,
yep,
interesting,
yep,
dark, disturbing film. And, you know, our friend Mr. Tarantino has actually said, your second film is arguably just as important as your first,
mm-hmm,
because you have to prove that you're not a fluke, right?
Right.
So this is the second film from Ari Aster. He did Hereditary,
yep,
before, which was one of my favorite movies of that particular year.
Just last year.
Yes. And I love this movie. Like, I really do. And I love this guy, this filmmaker, too. I think he is going to be something very special. I think he's going, ooh, to have a very interesting career. He's going... I'm getting like a Yorgos Lanthimos vibe from him. Like, he's doing some very interesting out-of-the-box things right off the bat, and I think he's destined for something very great. But this movie is like truly like indescribable. I don't quite know where to begin with it.
Yeah.
It's like Hereditary in the sense that he's obviously got guts, right? Like, he shows you some very disturbing stuff and is obviously not about sentimentality, is obviously not interested in making you feel nice and warm and fuzzy.
Oh, heaven forbid.
Yes. and is also not interested in like jump scares and cheap scares either. It's a very interesting film. But basically they go away to this Swedish camp or summer camp, you might say, where this ritual occurs every 90 years and they're kind of friends from America. Florence, I'm sorry, I don't know her last name.
I'm assuming it's Pa,
Pa, okay. She has like early in the film, experiences a pretty horrific tragedy.
Which is like, it's not like, again, it's not in the jump scare realm. It's like this long sort of tracking shot of you know, following from the garage where her sister has hooked up a pipe to the exhaust so that she can... Basically, she kills herself and her parents. Mm-hmm. And it's like this long tracking shot where you follow the hose up the stairs.
As these firefighters are going up the stairs as well.
Into the parents' room and then down the hall where she's like duct taped the other end of the hose like to her mouth, the sister, to kill herself. And it's just like this incredibly haunting
image. Yeah, he doesn't even try to be like subtle or like...
No.
I don't know what else.
No, but... it's not in the context of like these poor people. Mm-hmm. I think is what you're getting at. There's no sentimentality about it. It's just like this is a horrible thing that just happened, and then it smash cuts from there to Danny, who's the character played by Florence Paul, and where she's just bawling, and I don't know if you noticed this, but like. It's clear that she's been crying for a while because you see this in like kids, like when they're like really, really upset, where they're like, it seems like their voice starts to go as they're crying, where there's like this crick in their throat. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there like, what must of this woman have like tapped into to just be like, to get this upset?
Yes.
To play this one little scene right at the beginning of the film.
I mean, she is like... She goes through the ringer in this movie, yeah. Man. Like, it's not even the most that she goes through. It's like, and it's kind of a long film, too. Like, it's 140 minutes, right? Yeah. It takes a while for them to get to this summer camp type thing. And then when it does, there are little things that kind of foreshadow where this is going. Obviously, something very sinister is happening or is going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Same with Hereditary. He kind of gives it to you in little bits until we get... to like a very horrifying climax. Mm-hmm. It's all set like during the day. Almost none of this is like set at night. So it's this weird contrast between like, it's creepy, but it's not the traditional creepy vibe of a horror film that's set at night and there are shadows and people lurking around staircases and stuff like that. And the way that he kind of eases you into these people, like the Swedish population, you know, they're so warm and inviting.
Yeah.
And the way that he slowly kind of gives you that same with like that Jordan Peele did in Get Out, right? It's like the parents are so warm and inviting. And then we start to get glimpses of something not quite right.
Right.
And I will just say that there is one part where the kids like realize it's a very like, big moment, right? This ritual is occurring.
Yeah.
And the kids do not react, I think. Like, there are, there's these other British kind of couple
that is
there.
They're not the only outsiders there. Yeah.
Right. So there are this outsider couple, and they react the way that I think most people would traditionally react.
Right.
But Florence Pugh and her friends, I was like, all right, I definitely do not believe they would still be at this camp after witnessing that. But I can like buy it.
Well, they do set it up that like the idea that they're all like, or that a couple of them are like anthropology grad students. Mm-hmm. So like they're in the frame of mind like we're here to observe, not to like judge. And Jack Rayner has a line after that happens where he's like, you know, putting old folks in a nursing home probably seems like torture to them. So even in the midst of like the horrible thing they witness, there's the context. It's like, well, we're outsiders and we're judging them. And what would they say if they looked at our lives?
Yeah. Even then, I just, but, I, that was the one thing that I just didn't buy. But it was okay. And there are some like subplots as well that I feel like maybe were not totally necessary. He also did this with Hereditary. He kind of, I think, overwrote some of it. You're wondering where some of this. There's this kind of hostility between two of the friends. They're both writing their thesis and on the same thing. And he's like, well, I got the thesis first. None of it really has anything to do with anything.
I thought that was meant to reinforce that the Christian character was kind of a jerk.
Right.
Like, there's, you already kind of like have him on a, you're all kind of giving him side eye because he clearly doesn't want to be in a relationship with Danny anymore.
Yeah, but he can't kind of break up with her because her family has just died. So he's kind of in this weird situation.
But yeah.
And it's funny. I was reading this interview. Ari Aster, apparently, when he was in film school, he went to the AFI Film Academy, which is bizarre because that's like a film school that is designed to kind of usher you into the Hollywood system, to like go straight into Hollywood and make those kind of movies. And Ari Aster is obviously making like the least Hollywood-esque movies ever. So I can really admire him. But apparently what they would do...
Him in a different way.
Him and his buddies, they would think of the most like taboo things that you could possibly... Like things that you just could not make a movie about. Mm-hmm. And then they would obviously make a movie about those things. And, you know, you see some of his short films from school and even Hereditary. It's like... the guts that this guy has for like doing... Going those places, going to those places, going to such dark territory. It's a very unsettling movie. It's just
it's like you have that dark beginning, which sets a tone, and then you spend pretty much the rest of the movie waiting for it to kind of recapture that.
Yeah,
that that imagery, that like shocking imagery, which it does once. But the rest of the movie's kind of very low key about it. It's like this hum, like the dread is like this hum that you can't get rid of, that you keep hearing, that you try not to hear, but it's always there. Even in these, like as you said, it takes place in Sweden, so it's near the Arctic Circle, in the middle of summer, so it's daylight 22-23 hours of the day, and there's actually a lot of humor in this too. And one of the scenes is when they're tripping out. When they first get to the commune, and one of them asks what time it is, and I think it's Christian looks at his watch and says it's 9 p.m. and the other guy gets up and goes like, "No way, the sky is still blue."
Yeah,
and he's just
Will Poulter, who I love. Like honestly, talking about a guy who's worked with great directors, like Will Poulter is wonderful.
But I mean, the way he delivers that line, the outrage of it, is very humorous. But I mean, the whole film is. The cinematography, it's cloaked in this. It's not just that it's sunlight. It's like, I think the exposure is maybe higher than normal. Like the exposure has been turned up a bit, and maybe this was like something they didn't pose with color correction or something, but it's like, it's a little bit blanched out. So there's this kind of very dreamy, ethereal thing to it. And I fully expected like, some of the stuff that was happening, Ari Aster might like sort of play with the senses a bit. Like, are they still like maybe back at the first part, like tripping balls and like wondering what this thing is going to be like? But no, he plays it very, very straight, and the noose keeps tightening and tightening. And it's like the old metaphor about the frog slowly boiling in the pot of water, where you kind of accept like weird things are happening, like when the British couple you mentioned. Go to the train station and it's like, okay, that makes sense. And then like one of the friends like gets up from dinner and they're never seen again. And it's like, oh, he just went for a walk in the woods or something. And then, you know, at this point you kind of get wrapped up into like the final movement, but it is funny how you can almost get used to the unsettled nature of it and start like accepting things. Like you just go along with it too until you get to that final, the let's call it the grand finale.
Which is not quite as like visceral and horrifying as Hereditary, but still has some imagery.
Yes.
And it's still like quite a long sequence too. It's just unlike anything I've seen in like horror movies, right? It's not a traditional kind of horror climax, I mm-hmm. guess, like mm-hmm. a showdown between good and evil. It's just yeah. more of this is where you knew it was going, but you didn't know it was going to look like this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's, I think the signals, I mean, this would be an interesting film to go back and watch. I don't know if I want to go back and watch it tomorrow, but yeah. at some point I'll definitely go back and watch it and sort of look for what the clues are, because I think the clues are there. Because everything's so meticulously designed, like inside the cabin they're all sleeping in, with all the murals and things on the wall, I think all the signposts are there that you are heading to this place, and I don't think that the ending is like, it's not a twist ending, it's not a shocking ending. I think you're very aware that this is where it's going to go the whole time, and what you kind of I think what at the end of it is, it's like this meditation on grief and people who want to run away from them, from their grief and acceptance, and you know it's done in this very over the top, very visceral way. But I think, oddly enough, when you get to the end of the movie, there is a kind of peace. Like, you've been feeling the tension the whole film, but like when you get to the end of the movie and you get to the credits, you're like, okay, I feel good.
Yeah. And I would never suggest that this is accessible to like the average
no.
film goer,
no.
right? Like, this is kind of like,
do not take your kids.
no. Even I would even recommend that you watch Hereditary first, just to get a sense of what kind of,
it's a good double bill,
material he likes to do. Right. Mm-hmm.
And you can watch Hereditary in the safety of your home on Netflix right now.
True. Yes. Yeah. But it's like Robert Eggers, The Witch as well. They might advertise it as kind of this traditional horror film, but it's much slower. It's more deliberate.
Yeah.
And I think if you can get through it, because you are kind of wondering where it's going, but then when you kind of see the whole thing and you reflect on it as a whole piece, you can appreciate it more mm-hmm. than the kind of plodding moment by moment. Where is this going? What is that leading to? It's like, okay, I can accept its flaws. I can accept mm-hmm. its blemishes. And, but certainly it is not like the, if you are expecting like a slasher film or a haunted house kind of film, you're definitely not going to get that.
No.
There are some kind of like classic horror tropes, right? The kind of horny teenagers kind of thing, and people doing drugs and whatever.
People getting killed after sex.
Right.
And it, like, the whole thing starts, like, the basic concept is a group of college students go into the woods and bad stuff happens.
Right.
So it's like, it's got this, like, the base DNA of it is something that's very, very familiar, but it's a work unlike anything I can think of.
Yes. Yeah. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about.
Yeah.
A lot about.
Yeah. I left this film and I went home and I started like looking at like reviews and articles, like how other people are making sense of this. And I think that's a movie like this, that's part of the joy of this, is trying to sort out your feelings, trying to sort out what, you know, what other people are feeling. And I think it's worth seeing, and take a friend.
Absolutely. Yes.
Unfortunately, that will be the end of our show, and we do hope you like our show, and we always hope you like our show. And you can listen to us again. You can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your local podcast app, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. Find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Vince, where can people find you if they want to keep talking about Midsommar?
At VMassin5.
We should also say that you are manning the counter at Cinema One, so
I am, yes.
They can find you at your natural habitat.
You can, absolutely, yes.
I will be back here in my natural habitat at CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out GuelphPolitico.ca for my news and politics site. In the meantime, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will indeed be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.